Contagion kit is something new. Can you tell us about that and what's in it and what it's for?
Well, the Contagion kit is specifically geared towards a respiratory virus. It mm-hmm. includes some of the medications that we've been talking about that are well known to be able to treat respiratory viruses. And mm-hmm. importantly, it includes a nebulizer, a mm-hmm. way to aerosolize a liquid medication so that you can breathe it into the lungs. Mm-hmm. Again, these kits are not meant to replace your doctor or a relationship with a doctor. They are not meant for you to fly solo. We have telemedicine visits mm-hmm. available if you have any questions about the symptoms you're having. There is a booklet in there as well that supports and kind of coaches you through what symptoms you may be having from something. So these aren't meant to be a panacea to replace mm-hmm. everything in medicine. It's a way, however, for people to feel and to be prepared, to be at the ready, to be more resilient, and to be more immune from the sorts of intrusions that we saw during COVID, where your insurance company or your own doctor or the pharmacist or the pharmacy was refusing to let people get a hold of medication.
Hi, everybody. I'm Christine Dolan, and this is our Globalists in Plain Sight show. We started the show in May of 2022 because of the push to put national sovereignty under the World Health Organization. And I am honored today to have three people with us. As everybody knows, I've covered human trafficking all over the world for almost a quarter of a century now, before I covered politics and wars. And one of the issues that is on everybody's kitchen desk today is about transgender and the targeting of children. And I am somebody who, when it comes, I don't care whether you're the Pope or the president, I don't care if you're head of a pharmaceutical industry, I don't care if you are head of a hospital. I am all for the protection of children. And I firmly believe that when you're targeting children and you do not have informed consent, that that is child abuse. And so today I am honored to have three people, and I can't even express my appreciation for these three people coming on, because they are experts from the community of LGBTIQ+. They understand the history of the difference between the LGBT group and what's happening today in terms of the competition within that community. So with us today, we have Jamie Reed. Who, Jamie, even though you're not considered a government whistleblower, I consider you a whistleblower because you are a social worker, you have your master's degree, you worked at the St. Louis Clinic connected to Washington University, you saw things that you didn't particularly care for in that community, you were sensitive to it because of your personal life, and I appreciate the fact that you came forward and said, no, we should not be pushing these kids through as if this is a factory. Jeff Cleghorn, you have been a gay activist out there for, you know, over 30 years. You have seen the war between what people wanted years ago in terms of the no discrimination in the work, no discrimination in the military, same-sex marriage, and then you guys picked up and you went home, and then all of a sudden it's been taken over by some other group of people within this community. And Dr. Erica Anderson, I interviewed you last week. You are a psychiatrist or a psychologist?
Psychologist.
Psychologist who has clients who are dealing with gender dysphoria. And you too, you have been the president of WPATH USA. You were on the board of WPATH out of London. And you have come out and said, no, we need to be careful with these kids. So thank you all very much for joining us today, because this is a conversation when somebody like me, who's straight, doesn't understand the community. And I go to people who actually have lived the experiences the same way that I've never been a traffic victim. And 24 years ago, I started interviewing traffic victims the same way that I interviewed COVID vax injured when I started to report on that 3 years ago. So it's important that the audience recognizes you as experts and not me as a reporter. I'm just bringing out the truth from you. So thank you very much for joining us. Jamie, let's start with you. You've got your mic muted. Jamie, you know, give us your background. First of all, let's go around the circle here. I gave my, you know, my thoughts about your background, but let's talk about why, Jamie, you decided to take a job at the clinic.
So like you said, Jamie Reed, I am not technically a social worker. I worked in a social worker role. Okay. I have a bachelor's degree in.
Oh, you froze for a moment there.
Yeah, I'm slightly worried about my internet today. I had a hard time getting into.
Okay.
So I have worked in positions with the LGBT community for years, primarily as a caseworker in HIV for a number of years. And I have had significant ties to and worked with this community for a really long time. Working in that pediatric center was really just a natural kind of next step for me at that time in my career.
All right, Jeff, let's talk about your history here.
Jeff Cleghorn. I live in Georgia. I became a gay rights activist in 1993 while I was living in Washington, D.C., working at the Pentagon. I was an Army officer back then. During the years of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, when gays, or before Don't Ask, Don't Tell, actually, when gays and lesbians were not allowed to be in the military. So that's how I became involved in the gay equality movement, if you will. And over the subsequent years, I have been involved with staff and board level of a variety of gay advocacy groups at the national, state, and local level here in Georgia, including here in Georgia as well.
Erica.
Hi, everybody. Erica Anderson. I'm a clinical psychologist for 45 plus years in a long career as a psychologist. Was trained as a child and adolescent psychologist as well as an adult psychologist. And I've been a professor. I've run healthcare companies. I've been a consultant. And in the latter part of my career, I started to work very directly with trans people, particularly trans youth, in specific at the University of California San Francisco Gender Clinic, which is very well known in this work. And I became concerned about six, seven years ago about what I saw as shifting characteristics of the people, the kids particularly, who were coming to the clinic in San Francisco. And I started expressing my concerns, most notably in 2018 and Atlantic Monthly piece written by Jesse Single. I was on 60 Minutes 3 years ago expressing my concerns. I've been an opponent of outright bans, per se, of care for all gender-questioning youth, but I've expressed serious concerns that too many kids were being medicalized and shouldn't be, and that professionals were not sufficiently cautious, and in many cases weren't even observing the then existing guidelines. And of course, since that time, there've been many advances in terms of our understanding of these things, most particularly health authorities in Europe who have done very sophisticated, thorough reviews of all the evidence and found that the evidence underlying a medicalization of gender questioning youth is wanting. And as a consequence, all the health authorities in Europe have taken a huge pivot to offering psychosocial support for kids who are questioning their gender, but held back medicines for only rare cases and under clinical protocols. So I've been speaking out about this for a long time, as Jamie knows, and been concerned. And I'm now really disturbed by what's been going on in California, where meanwhile, in California, where the prevailing winds usually blow to the left, They've just signed into law a very draconian bill, AB 1955, which I spoke out against before it was being considered and subsequently. And it actually permits schools to socially transition kids and not tell parents. And it prohibits essentially school districts, who I have supported, from advising parents what's going on with their kids at school. It's effectively said, we know better than parents what's good for kids, and we're going to take your kids and do what we think is right for them. I also was very disturbed to find I had renewed my California license a few months ago, and a new law has been effected as of this month in California for all health professionals, and it affects me as a psychologist, in which the state has allowed minors down to age 12 to seek whatever healthcare services they want without parental consent, which is not only a slippery slope, it's a minefield. It is just horrendous. So I'm just waiting for the fallout from this. I've been involved in a number of lawsuits opposing the parent secrecy bills, which are in effect today in 1,000 school districts, affecting millions of children around the country. We've won two cases, one in Wisconsin on behalf of parents and another in California on behalf of teachers who take exception to these practices. And I'm still fighting the good fight to try to counter the ill effects of what we all call now gender ideology.
And
thank you,
Christine.
Go
can
ahead,
I
Jamie.
Jump in for just
absolutely.
A second? I just want to say, Dr. Anderson's piece and her writing was really, really influential in my own considerations of what was going on in our gender center. And it really had a very strong impact in some of those conversations within the center. And then just in terms of what's going on in California, I think, Dr. Anderson, you would even, you know, agree the original Dutch protocols never, ever imagined that we would be locking parents out of these conversations. It was always based on parental decisions and creating a family unit, and that there was family understanding. And so all of the way, just the way that the U.S. has just turned this completely on its head, has really gone down a path far divorced from the original concepts of even what the grounding was that might have made this potentially work for these kids.
Yeah, thank you, Jamie. Absolutely right. The Europeans don't recognize what's happened in America. I've been traveling to Europe, as has Jamie, for the last few years. I was doing it before before the CAS Commission, et cetera, et cetera. And my colleagues in Europe often ask me, has everybody in America gone mad?
Yes.
What is gone on in America? What is, because they think we're all crazy. Well, we're not all crazy, but too many.
So first of all, Jeff, you have nephews that you and I have spoken about that you're close to. Jamie, you have 5 children. Erica, you have a child.
True.
So your parents as well, all right, within this community. Now, Jamie, after our colleague Jackie Holman, I want to give credit to her, introduced me to Jeff. Jeff sent me your affidavit that you signed that the Attorney General in Missouri has used to fight this issue in Missouri. And what struck me, and this is why it is so significant, I know a lot of parents that have heard about the fact that the puberty blockers may cause infertility. And if you take them before puberty, it can cause infertility. But in your affidavit, in paragraph 62, as I remember, you talked about the FDA black box warning that came out in July of 2022. And the risk is that if you take these puberty blockers, you may go blind. So when we combine that with not having parental consent or keeping secrets from parents, which to me is predatory practices, That's what perverts do. They say, you know, they have sex, they rape kids, and then it's their secret and don't tell mommy and daddy and things like that. My head exploded when this issue came forward within the last 3 years as this huge wave now. And I'm thinking to myself, Planned Parenthood can hand out these puberty blockers like candy in many states. The parents don't know about them. If the child becomes blind, the parents are saddled with that. To me, this is absolute negligence on behalf of anybody who distributes this. Explain how you came to find out about that FDA warning. And did you know that, or did you find it out when you were working at the clinic?
I found that out when I was working in the clinic. And one of the things that we're kind of continuing to have discussions around is just simply that these are interventions that have true side effects, and that they are complex side effects, and that there should be complex screening involved before a patient is really considered a good candidate for some of these too. Pubertal blockade can be a very complex process in the body. And I think we've seen some evidence that even children who had these interventions used because they were experiencing early puberty had lifetime impacts that they are still addressing and dealing with. The issue really is we use so many drugs in pediatrics that are tested in adults that are rarely clearly tested in kids. And we simply don't often know the full profile of what you're signing a kid up for when you're signing a kid up for these treatments. But I think even beyond that, even beyond that these are hard and have side effects, I think we have to go back to what Dr. Anderson was talking about. There has to be a good evidence base for their use that shows they're effective. And I think what we're seeing out of these systematic reviews is there's really questionable, does this have a good effect? And if it doesn't have a good effect, then why are we putting kids through this possible huge list of side effects? It's just not good evidence for kids, unless you have really strong evidence that its impact is the benefit that you're seeking.
Jeff, you have said to me in the past, as has Robert, who was introduced to me, you have said that if you were a child today, you may be somebody that this contagion wave would have targeted.
Well, I don't know. I would hope, it's a complicated situation, and Dr. Anderson and Jamie are far more adept in speaking of the medical and psychological and mechanical parts of it. But, you know, just from the street level, as a longtime activist and a lawyer who has represented a large number of gay and lesbian and transgender people as well over the past several decades in a variety of different types of situations, it was never the case during the gay rights movement in the 90s or even in the aughts that we were focusing on children. The 1993 March on Washington, which was kind of my coming out, if you will, in terms of committing to activism, an event where hundreds of thousands of gay and lesbian people came to Washington from all over the country to speak out early in the Bill Clinton administration in support of gay rights. And this was, you know, back in the day when the world was a very different place. There was AIDS, there was there were sodomy laws, there was a ban on military service. You could not get a security clearance if you were gay back then, etc. So there was work to be done, and we set about that work. And at every step of the way, we were hit by those who opposed us with allegations that we were targeting children, we were after children, you know, the pedophile thing. So we've always had to fight back and deflect against that, at least at the activist level. in terms of communicating to people and just telling our stories, telling the truth. And, you know, you form your own mind, but let's have a conversation. I'm not going to call you names. I'm not going to threaten, bully, intimidate you. I'm not going to try to force you to like me. I'm simply going to tell my truth in a dignified way. And then you make up your own mind. That's all we ask. And when we do that, we see time and again now for several decades, when we do that, we win. Time and again, success has followed the approach by advocates and activists to simply be good and decent people and tell the truth, meet people where they are, have a conversation. I'm from an evangelical, devoutly conservative background and family. So, you know, these are my people and I have a familiarity with talking with them about complicated issues, certainly at this point in my life. But, you know, what would have happened had this been going on when I was a kid? I don't know. You know, there are when you're a kid and you grow up to be gay, at least in my experience, I was aware that something was different, but you're not in puberty. You're not a sexual being, really. And you know, nothing makes sense at that point. So when children today are hearing things, whether it's online, as many of them are, or whether it's now in schools, as Dr. Anderson has mentioned, or in children's books, or in drag queen story hour, or whatever the vehicle, when children are being told today, they're being proselytized and propagandized to believe in the make-believe, to believe in these made-up imaginary identities, these made-up imaginary genders, these made-up imaginary pronouns. Who does this appeal to? It appeals to children. Children, you know, adults aren't going to change our pronouns to Zer or whatever fake words they use.
They do now, though.
Well, but these are overwhelmingly behaviors that the extremist elements of the transgender movement today are targeting and pushing on children because children are more vulnerable and more susceptible. And if you happen to be a kid like me who was going to grow up to be a gay man eventually, if left alone, then you know you may well be more susceptible to these things because you're sensing that something's different. And, you know, it becomes a popular little thing. I mean, the some of the online influencers that I see just really turn my stomach. They're promoting very aggressively to children, you know, a panacea that is without an evidentiary base. And then you've got the Biden administration and Dr. Rachel Levine, who is the Department of Health and Human Services medical doctor and a public health service admiral and a senior federal government official saying often and adamantly and a transgender woman, Dr. Levine is saying publicly and adamantly using the bully pulpit of the federal government that this is all evidence-based and it's all medically necessary and it's all gender affirming and it's all life-saving. And none of that is true. In terms of saying those broad statements applying to children of any age. And if a kid says, hey, I might be a boy or I might be a girl, then you're required by California and some other jurisdictions now to affirm them automatically. And only even therapists are having their hands tied and they're not allowed in some states to even explore what might else be going on with these kids. So, you know, a lot of kids, and we know from the evidence that has been uncovered over in the United Kingdom, a lot of these children indeed are gay and lesbian kids and will grow up, if left alone, to be, you know, hopefully happy homosexuals as adults. But yeah, this is seductive. It's really seductive. And that part of it is what got me involved and kind of came out of retirement as an activist to where, you know, now a lot of the activist friends who I have known and worked with for a long time all over the country, you know, a lot of those folks won't even talk to me anymore because I'm having conversations like this and I don't know why. They're afraid to speak out or they have drank the Kool-Aid and they actually think that what Dr. Rachel Levine is saying is true when it's not. It's profoundly dishonest. And you know, there's social and financial pressures now to keep your mouth closed. And those who do speak out are going to get called ugly names and, or worse, if you're a female, especially you know, you've got the bullseye on you because the trans activists in particular, the trans identified male activists, mostly heterosexual men, most of them are very angry towards women when women push back. I mean, they physically assaulted Riley Gaines, for example, a year or two ago at an event in San Francisco, physically assaulted her because they didn't like what she was saying. So this stuff hovers around children. It's happening all over. It's happening in Georgia school districts way outside the city of Atlanta. Anecdotes that I'm hearing about, and parents are dealing with this and trying to figure out which way's up. So they turn to the experts like Dr. Rachel Levine in these gender clinics. And, you know, they look to the doctors and the medical experts for guidance. And when a doctor tells you something, you know, most of us tend to think the doctor's telling us what we need to do and, you know, follow that advice. So it's just a mess.
Let me pick up on that. Erica, we have spoken about this. You tell the parents, you tell your clients the truth. Why is it that a lot of psychiatrists, and Jamie, after Erica, I want you to jump on this. Why don't the staff at the clinics, for instance, tell people about the risks, and why is it that they're pushing these kids and these families through this factory? Because these are life-changing experiences. Your mic is muted, Erica.
Thank you. As Jeff was saying, a lot of them have drunk the Kool-Aid and adopted a perspective that really can best be characterized as what they believe, which is not supported by the evidence. I mean, we have, much to our chagrin in America, health professionals and more often activists who are dismissing the CAST Commission report in the UK, which
let's
is the largest.
Let's explain that to the audience.
Dr. Hilary CAST, who's a highly respected, actually just made a peerage in the House of Lords, pediatrician, former head of the Royal College of Pediatricians, was commissioned by the National Health Service in the UK to evaluate gender youth care, particularly as it has happened at Tavistock, which is the National Gender Center in London in the UK. And she produced, over a period of 4 years, almost 400-page report in which she and her team reviewed everything there was to review, including all of the literature. She commissioned through York University 6 or 7 independent systematic reviews on various aspects of this. She interviewed people from all over the world. I've talked to her many times. She reviewed whatever existing guidelines there might be, including those relied on in the United States from the American Academy of Pediatrics and WPATH and so on and so forth. And the conclusion of her team was that there were only 2 sets of guidelines that were really evidence-based, and those were in Sweden and Finland, and they advocate the cautious approach I was referring to earlier. And this report has really been quite explosive in terms of calling into question the practices of many people in the United States and Canada. I also advise some provinces in Canada about these issues. And there's a huge pushback because people are ideologically captured. And I find, much to my chagrin, some of my former colleagues in WPATH leadership are actually invoking activists to justify continued adherence to this ideological position. And they're making criticisms that are completely unfounded. They've been debunked in many different ways about the CAST Commission report. And anyway, back to this. So the CAST Commission report is a watershed. And I think those of us in this field will know there's a before the CAST Commission and there's now after the CAST Commission. Now I would say there's no excuse for anybody anymore to pass along the misinformation that has been passed around, including by, with all respect, Dr. Rachel Levine, mm-hmm. that the science is settled, that gender-affirming care is life-saving, that it prevents suicides. There are multiple studies that show it's not. The leading expert on suicide in the UK has weighed in and said there's no evidence that quote, gender-affirming care. And when the people are using gender-affirming care, they're most often talking about medicines, puberty blockers, and cross-sex hormones. surgeries occur rarely in minors, but they do occur, and in many cases,
well, the upper operations on girls definitely do occur.
Fatal girls who are trans masculine affirming, and actually, that population is represented in greater proportion in the group of people now coming forward who are, quote, detransitioning, mm-hmm. who are saying that the transition they underwent when they were younger, in many cases younger teenagers, they now realize was a mistake. They felt very strongly at the time. They had professionals who were encouraging them. And so we have a kind of a hot mess. And whereas in Europe, by contrast, you know, in the United Kingdom and most of the countries of Western Europe, where they have done the systematic evidence reviews, they've concluded what we know, which is the evidence is weak to very weak supporting these medical interventions, and they've pivoted away. But they have health authorities that are sanctioned by the federal government, and the health authorities advise all health providers and make those requirements of them, the National Health Service, foremost among them in the United Kingdom. We don't have that in the United States. They have kind of something like that in Canada, but they're so ideologically captured. There's a big fight going on in Canada. But in the United States, we have such a mess. We don't have a health system. We have this hodgepodge. So unfortunately, the tried and true way in the United States is changed through lawsuits. And of course, I and others who are expert in this area are being invited to weigh in on quite a number now of medical malpractice suits that are being initiated to sue providers who relied on standards that for which there isn't sufficient evidence. And in some cases, they ignored even the existing guidance, which called for individualized evaluation of any co-occurring mental health or mental health issues. And I'm involved in some of those lawsuits as well. It's really appalling. But those of us who are doing this are trying to speak up, educate people, call for reform, and call for compassion for all the people who are kind of caught in this God, meat grinder. It's just a horrible situation.
Well, it's the business of mutilation of children. Jamie, why did they push people through the clinic in St. Louis? Was it because of money?
I do believe initially there were so many providers who thought that this was the compassionate right way to move forward with kids. And I think there will be long-term questions about how these practices came to the U.S., how they were scaled up quickly, was there enough research oversight before they were scaled up and pushed out across the U.S. But I have compassion too for a number of the clinicians who initially really stepped into this care model, because there was this belief that if we intervene early, that we might prevent suffering for a number of these young people in the long term. The issue is once you know better, you need to do better. And yeah. That is where I think these systems are failing. We know better now. We have better evidence now. And once you have that knowledge, it's time to put on the brakes and figure out ways to find better pathways forwards for these kids and families. And right now, what that looks like is that strong psychotherapeutic interventions first is the model that we should be scaling up and looking at. And instead, you have states like California that are doing almost the exact opposite.
All right. So before this issue came on my radar at the acceleration it has in the last 3.5 years, I knew about the Johns Hopkins trans clinic in the 1960s. And John Money lied. I mean, the guy was the first generation after Alfred Kinsey. He was part of the people who believe from the womb to the tomb, everybody is sexual, intergenerational, incest sex. I mean, anything goes, even pedophilia. All right. I know about Table 34, about Alfred Kinsey using pedophiles to create the basis of that theory around the whole sexual issue. At the same time, that clinic at Johns Hopkins was shut down in 1979 because what Money did, his research was based upon fraud, and he lied about what he was doing at the time. So how in God's name do we have now in the United States in the last, I want to say, 12 years, and depending upon whose numbers we believe in, as Abigail Schreier has said, we either have 300 or 400 clinics in the United States, because my investigative skills, you know, ignite me in the direction of this is a business and who is making money off of this and who is pushing this. And this is an agenda, because if you say that the parents don't have a say and they don't even have the information and you're putting kids at risk for long term life changing experiences. I mean, this to me, this is very dark. It's very evil. It's very predatory medicine. How did we get to this point in time? Does anybody have an answer?
Can I jump in? I want to elaborate on a point that Jamie was making, which was the reliance upon what some of the early researchers were doing with gender questioning kids in Europe, particularly in the Netherlands. But what people don't realize is in the Netherlands, they didn't use puberty blockers until later in puberty, 10 or 4 or 5, which is usually translates to maybe 15, age 15, 16. When the initiative came to the United States to use puberty blockers, they were following the Netherlands, but then a lot of people got over enthusiastic and started saying, well, if we can block puberty at 10 or 4 or 5, why not go to 10 or 2 at the very beginning of puberty at age 12, 11, 12, 13? And then that really took off. And too many people in the United States started thinking of gender questioning as a medical condition, gender dysphoria as a medical condition, like, and some have literally said this, like diabetes, just give them the medicine, they'll be fine. Yeah. Another thing I want to point out is that this rapid increase in numbers asserting a gender. So we have also the advent of lockdown with COVID, when so many kids were deprived of attending school in person and seeing other kids in the school, at school and in the neighborhood. So they relied on, then they just went online. And then that's when we have this explosion, as Jeff was suggesting, of influencers, some of whom are clearly predatory and really disturbing, telling kids all kinds of garbage and very dangerous garbage. So what I'm heading to is we have now a heterogeneous group of kids asserting a gender or sexual identity different than cisgender or straight. And not all of them, in my opinion, are going to turn out to be transgender in adulthood or persistent in their a different gender identity. And this is something the CAS Commission report discussed quite thoroughly. But people in the United States are, they don't say gender questioning, which is my preferred term for this podcast. Mm-hmm. They say
trans kids.
They say transgender. And this belies the fundamental point that I think Jamie and I are making, which is they just completely go past evaluation. It's like, you know.
So it's a fait accompli. If Sally comes in and says, "Mummy, call me Billy," Mummy's supposed to just go along with that and not question.
Yeah, exactly. And so that comes back in my experience to this issue with schools. Schools that are teaching ideology to younger children, pre-pubertal children, like, well, you can just choose your gender and it's everything's fine. Everything's just as good. You know, it's up to you. Are misleading children, and they're providing a misdirection, and then, you know, most children, I mean, I'm a psychologist for all these years. And I've studied developmental psychology, and we know that choice is one of the most powerful reinforcers that humans can have. Do you want vanilla or chocolate? Right. Well, if you give a child a choice, they're going to make a choice. They're not going to say, oh, no, I'm not going to choose. They're going to, oh, am I a boy? Am I a girl? Am I a neither? Am I a raccoon? And so what we've done is a huge disservice, flying in the face of what we know about cognitive and social development of children. And it's a really, it's a hot mess that we have to get out of.
All right. So I can hear before Jamie, before we go, we're going to have you on the other side, but we need to go to a commercial break. I can hear Todd, you know, saying we need to go to a commercial break. So Todd, let's take it away for a commercial.
This is a special report. Knowing how to invest your money is harder than ever before. Dealing with stock market volatility, record debt, and terrorist attacks requires new thinking. At U.S. Asset Management, we can help you see the world more clearly so that you can move beyond the chaos and invest with confidence. Call us, visit us online, or drop by our office. U.S. Asset Management, helping you make better decisions with your money.
If we have a financial crisis, one of the things you're going to want to be able to do is to barter and to buy goods and services, obviously. And if you're out of dollars or the ATM's down or you're locked down or you need a way to pay for something and maybe the current financial system just doesn't exist, check out these prepper bars. They break into little pieces, different grams of silver or gold, and you can carry them in your wallet, break a piece off to pay for whatever you need at the time. It's a fantastic idea. They're sold at cdmbar.com. Check it out. And get some prepper bars and be ready. Thanks.
Okay, we're back. And oh, Jamie lost her connection again. That's okay. I'm expecting her to come back. So let me ask you something, because I found this to be interesting. In the year 2000, when I was investigating trafficking in Europe, I would go down to the red light districts, and there's always a section where the transvestites would stand. And I went up to them just instinctively after the cops had educated me about the insidious market for infants, toddlers, little kids. And I just thought that some of the transvestites had been victims of child abuse. I took them to dinner. They took me dressing. I dressed up. I hung out with them in the red light districts to get close to where the market was. How many people, Erica, that come into your office, how many people ask the question, is this child who thinks that they need a different gender or who identify at a different gender? How many of the psychologists ask the question, if those children have been sexually abused?
Unfortunately, too few. A thorough evaluation should investigate everything potential that could be a factor in leading a child to being where they are. And we do know that many people who ultimately have a transgender identity have had ACEs, adverse child experiences of many kinds. And so it is very unfortunate. It hurts me to hear some of the really strident rhetoric about, you know, dismissing people who are trans as though they don't need help or they don't need compassion. What kind of help is the question? And I'm talking about older people, adults. Young people, as we know, experiment with all kinds of things, experiment with identities, experiment with experiences, and so forth. And what we're dealing with now is a huge cohort of adolescents who, in the process of their ordinary development of identity, which is a developmental task in adolescence, they're now adding to the mix gender identity and sexual identity, sexual orientation. You may appreciate that I'm older. I'm in my 70s. I just went to my 55th high school reunion, and I graduated in a large public high school in Minnesota with 806 classmates in my class. I didn't know any were gay because that was the 60s. Nobody was gay. At least people weren't out, as Jeff K. can school us. And but subsequently, of course, people did emerge, you know, quietly at first, and then over time it became more acceptable, I guess, safer. So we have something going on now that really has never happened before. I think arguably this is my third cohort of adolescents in my career as a psychologist. I've never seen anything like this before, where there's so much intermingling and exploration of sexuality and gender identity. And the irony is, a lot of the kids who are adopting these different gender identities are not exploring their sexuality in the way that historically teenagers have. They're certainly not having sex with another person. So these identities almost become divorced from reality, which is why you see some of these super wacky things, you know, claiming that their gender is space gender, and, you know, and they're offended by some of the criticisms of Star Wars and, you know, all the preoccupation with pronouns and so on and so forth, because their core identity is very unstable.
So let me ask you this question. Mm-hmm. Since you've been doing this so long, Dr. Anderson, how much influence do you think that we talk about influencers today, we know that, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, pushing COVID shots. We know that the pharmaceutical companies have gone out there and have paid, quote unquote, influencers. These are people who people watch who may have 2 million people as their audience out there. Those people we paid to push things. So I call them pimps. That's what they are. They're pimps for a cause. Pimps for an agenda, pimps for politics. What doesn't matter to me. How much on children today? Because we have, in this statistic, I say this because it really resonated with me, 230 million Americans in the United States, close to 80 million of them are children born after 1990. So they do not know the world that you and Jeff and I grew up in, all right? Yeah. The world pre-internet. Yeah. And we grew up in the generation of knowing what it meant to the Madison Avenue definition, push in terms of advertisement for behavior. We know that in the Silicon Valley, for over 20 years, they have hired what they call behavioral scientists in your field, but they're really behavioral modification psychiatrists. So do we have pharma that makes money off of this? Do we have the medical industry that makes money off of this? Hiring people with Silicon Valley behavior modification to influence children to think this is normal, and everybody is now all of a sudden trans or a furry or something. I mean, how much is influence and how much is reality?
Well, there's a lot of influence. I've been asked for years, you know, how much social influence is a factor with adolescents who adopt these identities. And it's almost always a factor, because we are in a different society, as you point out, Christina. You know, like, it's more acceptable to be gay or lesbian than ever before. It's kind of no big deal for most people in the United States. And so there is that. And as you point out, this generation has grown up on social media and at a level that is kind of unbelievable. One of the dirty secrets, it's not a secret really anymore, is that, yes, there were at work people who were causing the development of algorithms to push content to users of social media.
Right.
And this is a really concerning thing.
It should be, especially when we talk about AI, because what people don't understand is behind, we throw out this word algorithm as if, you know, it's something that is elusive, when in fact it's a human being. It's a team of people. It's what they have, a set goal. They hire these people and they figure out how to get to the point A.
Right. And we do know that overconsumption of social media, gaming, et cetera, is deleterious. I mean, I hate to over dramatize it, but the shooter who almost assassinated President Trump was a gamer.
That's right.
And, you know, like, caught in the fantasy world of, you know, whatever. I mean, a lot of fantasy. And so a lot of these kids are consuming 4 or 5 or more hours of content like this a day. Schools are now having to retrench. We're seeing the signs that some schools are now saying, if you have a smartphone, you can't have it with you during classes, during school. You have to check it in your locker or the whatever. Or schools saying, you can have a phone that you can make phone calls. You need to receive a phone call from your family or make one to your family. You can have that phone, but not this device, which basically you're looking at under your desk all day and not paying attention to school. We have so many problems in schools. I mean, the kids deprived of instruction at schools in the conventional way and lagging behind. We have a whole generation of kids who went to school during this 4 or 5 year period who are now forever behind.
Mm-hmm.
Where the experts I observe say, and I believe them, that there's no way that these kids can catch up.
You Jeff, I'm going to bring you back in here because somebody you know created the pronouns, and I forget how many, were there 85, 65 more pronouns? You actually know Paula over at Hopkins.
Yeah, a longtime personal and professional friend and colleague of mine is a transgender woman named Paula Neera. Paula is with Johns Hopkins University, and Paula helped open or reopen the Johns Hopkins gender clinic, pediatric gender clinic in 2017, I think. And
yes,
was the clinical program director there at Johns Hopkins for a few years. Johns Hopkins fairly recently released a list of new pronouns, and I forget the number, Christine, I think it was 50 something different pronouns, words, and combinations of vowels and consonants that no one had ever heard of and that they make no sense. And again, I'm convinced that this has to be targeting towards children just because of the silliness of it all, the imagination that's necessary to try to make sense of it, that, you know, it's really childlike. And so Johns Hopkins also has been amongst several recent scandals, you know, having been born initially from the notorious Dr. John Money, as you mentioned. Johns Hopkins recently got in trouble for writing new definitions, and they defined the word lesbian to mean a non-man attracted to a, what was it? A non-man attracted to a non-man. I forget exactly now.
I think that's how they phrased it. Yeah.
I mean, in other words,
are these people crazy? I mean, seriously. why does anybody think that this has any intellectual value?
Oh, and my friend Paula, when I asked back before Paula stopped talking to me, we had several long conversations, and I asked these questions. I had a lot of questions because what I was hearing in recent years was very different, very, very different from what I was hearing 20 years ago. And things they were saying today, they were not saying 20 years ago.
Right.
They were saying 20 years ago, they no longer say today. It used to be they would say genders between the ears and sexes between the legs. And, you know, it's a mismatch. And you just kind of like, okay, well, all right, fair enough. And not think much about it. But now they're saying that sex itself, that a penis doesn't mean anything, that sex itself is on a spectrum and a social construct, and gender and sex are, you know, it's just all mixed up and it's irrational, contradictory.
So how did we get here? What's the driving force?
I think the gobbledygook, as I sometimes call it, is a byproduct of an assumption, and that is everything's equally okay. Whatever you want is okay.
Isn't that considered nihilism, Erica?
You could call it that, exactly. I have a colleague at UCSF who's a professor of medicine and OBGYN and taught medical schools gynecology and started to get students in medical school saying to her, oh, you can't use that word. The word being woman, that word being vagina. And she's talking to me and kind of blowing her mind, saying, where does this go? And it does go to nihilism and oblivion. to obliterate scientific facts. I come back to there is biological reality.
Right. You know,
there is biological reality. And gender might be something different. And the gender dysphoria definition is, you know, one's gender identity might not be a perfect match with biological sex. And there are people who for whom that is true. I am one of them, by the way. I think the two of you know this, but that's a far cry from saying whatever you want in terms of defining your gender and your pronouns and so forth is okay. And the other thing that I really take strenuous exception to is the militancy of some, I'm going to say mostly younger people, who think that they can dress however they want in some discordant way with any stereotypes that we would recognize, and use whatever language that they adopt, and then insist everyone else adopt it, as though it's perfectly sensible for them to expect the world to conform to what they want. And they are sadly mistaken. The evolutionary psychology tells us that the brain operates in a way to recognize humans from everything else and to recognize in almost instantly potential threat value that's hardwired into our brains. And very quickly, is the person a one gender or the other, because it's relevant to the first judgment about safety, because historically in almost all human societies, male persons have been more aggressive than female persons.
So is it true that when, if they put a little girl on these puberty blockers, is it true that they actually become more aggressive? In some cases?
No. Puberty blockers don't cause mood changes.
Okay. So let me back up.
Are you talking about testosterone?
Yes.
Okay. So I get that question from parents a lot, of trans masculine asserting natal females. You know, well, are they going to become more aggressive? We don't know is the honest answer. But we do know that testosterone does tend to promote muscle strength and aggressiveness in general, which is why there are issues with natal males who are even trans feminine competing with natal females in sports. Because testosterone...
I have to tell you something. I don't really care about anybody's sexual being, okay? As far as I'm concerned, this is way too much information for society at this point. I'm beginning to sound like my late mother, all right?
Yeah.
It's too much information, but I take great exception that anybody can think, and I don't care whether they're straight, gay, lesbian, trans, it doesn't matter to me. Anybody that thinks that they can target somebody else's child and infiltrate anybody else's family and keep secrets from the parents who are the primary caretakers of their own children. This drives me crazy because it's so predatory.
Yes, I agree.
And people should be ashamed that we're living in a country where many Western civilized countries have said, no, we're not going along with this. It's not just putting on the brakes. They're screeching the brakes like they are in the UK. They're going to permanently ban this in the UK now with the new government over there. Yeah. But we're not taking any type of precautions here. Do we land this on the fact that Biden has thrown the entire federal government behind the LGBTIQ+? Jeff, what do you think? You think this is more politics because of the money involved on a political scale?
My guess is you'd have a hard time finding anybody working in the White House that could have this conversation we're having right now. Let's put it that way. The power that has been accumulated by these former gay rights groups, the groups like the Human Rights Campaign and GLAAD or Lambda Legal, which is like the gay ACLU. I'm a former board member of Lambda Legal. Georgia Equality, our state level group here in Georgia. I am a former board member of Georgia Equality. These groups were created and built and created by gay men and lesbian women to get gay rights. That's what was going on. And
Absolutely. And if I may, I think they sort of, without realizing it, kind of assumed that the issues with trans were the same as gay and lesbian issues. They are not. And that's where they're mistaken. Telling parents what's going on with their gender questioning child at school is not outing kids like outing gay or lesbian kids might have been in a different generation. So we have a lot of issues that that I think on the first blush aren't as simple as someone would depict them, and it's very unfortunate.
Well, we are running out of time. I'm going to have you back. I'm sorry that Jamie had such hard problems with her technology on her end, but we're going to regroup on this because I want to continue this conversation, and I want to continue this conversation with everybody else. I want people to understand, and Jeff and Erica, just before we sign off on this, explain the blowback that you have received from your community because you are courageous, and I know this is very difficult for people in your community who disagree with what's going on. Jeff, first of all, explain how tough this has been.
Well, unfortunately, it's been politicized, and that's part of what mystifies the people in Europe about how we're handling this in the United States, is it's gotten caught in the political gutter, where if you speak out expressing concern or even opposition to gender identity ideology, then you are categorized and lumped in with the conservatives and the Republicans, and they call us the far right. The Southern Poverty Law Center now calls the new gay rights group, Gays Against Groomers, far right, for example. And I'm a member of the Georgia Gays Against Groomers chapter, a proud member. And I, Jeff Cleghorn, am now called far right. So the blowback is real, and these organizations that were built by gay people for gay rights, when we finished, they were taken over by this new ideology looking for new ways to raise money and new ways to keep the bureaucracy of these organizations going. So there's a lot of politics going on it at the big picture level. It's just assumed if you're concerned about this or if you oppose it, then they call you a bad guy. They call you names and they shut you down. The progressive liberal media, the mainstream media, has done only a limited amount of reporting on this for that reason, because, you know, in my view, they are by and large biased towards the progressive view. And back when I was a gay rights activist, that worked to my advantage. You know, I could go on national television and talk about this stuff and, you know, would oftentimes wonder where were the people on the other side to push back at me, because that's what brought the value and that's what I enjoyed. That's why you change hearts, how you change hearts and minds. You have the give and take. But the bias on the part of the media on the left creates the situation where the lion's share of the coverage of this is being done by more conservative media, which is great. There's some fantastic A-plus coverage happening. I'm grateful for it, very grateful. But we need to expand this conversation in the United States to include progressive populations. We have to find ways to get them to listen to us and to just at least plant the seeds of doubt, get them to start thinking, listening, reading books, and figuring it out, instead of assuming that what Dr. Rachel Levine and the Human Rights Campaign is saying is true, because they're not telling the truth.
Right. That's right. They're not telling the truth. Erica, you have the last word.
Well, thank you. Well, like Jeff, I've been reviled in my own community for speaking the truth, basically. And more people are coming around than that, and I'm grateful for that, but it's taken a while. And, you know, it's been a cost for me. It's unpleasant. It's particularly unpleasant to be misunderstood, because I've been advocating for trans people for years. But I mean, I basically left the leadership of WPATH because I said, we have to talk about all these things and be transparent. And I was basically overruled. You know, they said basically, you know, shut up and sit down. And I said, you know, under these circumstances, I'm leaving. And of course, what's happened since is some of the internal squabbles have been more fully revealed, and the doctrinaire position of many people there have been now disclosed. I would say it's similar in some other professional organizations, which I have not yet spoken about publicly, but will eventually, including my own American Psychological Association. that I think largely is ideologically captured. And I've been criticized by colleagues who are psychologists, some. I take to heart all legitimate criticism, but the name calling and threats are pretty transparent. You know, these are people who are threatened. They don't like what I say, but they don't have a counter to it.
And people have to remember that we all grew up in an age where people would say sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never hurt you. So that's what we need to get back to, so that we need to get all these young people to stop being Twinkies and to feel that they have to, that their validation is agreement, because again, that's not dealing with reality too. We need to have, as you said, to have these conversations. And I would bet my life that they're not having these conversations in the White House. They're not having it on the left. They're not having it in the Democratic Party. And that's the saddest part about it, because what we're talking about is life altering changes for children and the impact on the families and the parents. God bless you guys for speaking out. We're going to have you back. And I'm sorry we lost Jamie, because she's a real hero to me too, for speaking out. But we'll see you soon. And thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.